Good evening, everybody. We're right in the middle of chapter 2, Parakbet. In the blue books, we're learning. It starts at the bottom of page 14. Page 14, Leviatar Kohen. In that book, that one I can tell you exactly, which is page 23, which is even better. Page 23. But in the blue books, it's page 14. What it is in the art scroll, I can't say. You always have to say the art scroll at the end. What we are managing to do, which I'm quite pleased about, I have to say, is essentially it's like a chapter every 2 weeks. These are very long parakim. These are long chapters. As we get further into the book, some of the parakim will be able to cover, as we did with Shmuel Bet, more or less on a weekly basis. But at the moment, the parakim are taking approximately 2 weeks. I'm just giving you advance notice, for those who want to read ahead, that chapters 6, 7, and 8 are not going to be covered in any sort of detail. I'll set it for home reading, because it's really the details of building the temple and a lot of building construction there, and I'm not really going to go through much of that. I want to talk a bit about what happened at the end of chapter 8, and the beginning of chapter 6, but that's basically what we're doing there. So we will find that, in fact, by the end of this semester, we will hopefully be towards the end of Shlomo HaMelech, not quite in a fair way. We'll be missing out two or three chapters, but that's just the way it is. But saying that, at the moment, we're right in the middle of this very intriguing hit list. Remember last week, we saw that David left a list of names of people who he warned his son, he warned Shlomo, said, Shlomo, my son, I'm about to die, and there are a number of gentlemen in the country that you've got to be very careful with. And we saw already Adoniol gave the perfect excuse for Shlomo to declare a death sentence, and he was killed. And now we've got to deal with the other very, very dangerous individual that David warned Shlomo about, which is his cousin Yoav. Now, again, you know, it's all so interesting to me that the family connections here don't seem to be, I suppose it's true in many families. I've been to Shiva houses where literally the siblings are sitting in different rooms, and not out of religious reasons, I assure you. You know, this is not Hasidish or anything like that. It's just that for 30 years, the brothers never spoke, so one brother died, so the other brother sitting Shiva had to sit in a separate room, and that to me was tragic. It was unbelievable that people are like that. But seemingly there's nothing new under the sun. In Chadash Tachan HaShemesh, you know, you got here happy families or unhappy families in the time of David. Of course, I hope you all noticed that last week's Haftarah was chapter 1 of Malachim. So we were a bit ahead of the game, and a lot of interesting suggestions about why that Haftarah is connected to the Parsha. I spoke to Lenny about it sort of in terms of the analysis, not just the beginning, where it says David Baba Yomim and Avram was Baba Yomim. We know that they were very old and they were coming to the end of their lives, but also the fact that there is a story with Eliezer which is repeated twice at least, and all the details. And we saw when we analyzed Perek Aleph that the story also was repeated a number of times. So there's also a theme of repetition, which generally speaking is very unusual. Right, there's no extra words in the Torah. We know there's no extra words in Tanakh. And therefore, the idea of repetition maybe is also another reason why that Haftarah was chosen, the whole Haftarah, not just the beginning part, but the whole story, to be the Haftarah for Parsha Chayisara, which is also a repetitive Parsha. So that was kind of an interesting insight, which I just wanted to share with you. Alright, going back to the rather messy business over here, we're at Pasuk Chav Vav, verse 26 of Perek Bet. And I gave you a handout here from the Gemara. We'll see in a minute what this handout is about. There's two handouts this evening. Hopefully we'll get to, and hopefully finish the Perek. That's the plan. You know, hopefully that's the way it is. All right, Perek Bet Posach Chava. We've now, Adoniel is gone. He's out of the picture. And there was a follower of Adoniel, a guy called Eviatar. Eviatar Kohen. Eviatar Kohen was in fact a survivor from the story of Nov. If you remember, right back in Shmuel Aleph, there was a story, there was a massacre at the city of Nov as a result of the fact they gave refuge to David, and Shaul came there afterwards and deemed them, all the Kohanim living there, to be Morid B'Malchut, And Doeg Odomi carried out the death sentence. We saw that story, a very tragic story. And Eviatar was the one guy who survived. So it's, apparently it's the same Eviatar. There's a debate about it, but it would seem that this might be sort of, you know, this might hold up. So, Pasuk Chavav, and we'll just go through the Psukim and see what happens. Eviatar Kohen. So we got this guy Eviatar who was supporting Adonio. Omar HaMelech. The king said to him, Anatot Lech El Sadecha. Go home. Al Sadecha, to your fields in Anatot. All right, wherever Anatot is. Sounds like Anatevka, but it's not quite the same place. Ki ish movet ata, because you are a man of death. In other words, you deserve to die. You were part of the rebellion. But you know what? I have respect for you, because when you originally ran away from Nob, you supported my father David. This is what Shlomo is saying. And therefore, as a result of doing a good deed, you deserve a break. You deserve a chesed. So this is what he says. Ubayom azeh lo amitecha. I won't kill you today. Implication being, it may still happen in the future. Just watch your back. Ki nasat et aron Hashem Elokim lifnei David avi. You carried the ark in front of my father David. Veki hitanita b'chol asher tane avi. And you went through all the afflictions that he went through. And this is referring back to the story of Nob. So basically, Shlomo said to Eviatar, at the moment, you're a lucky guy. You got an amnesty from me. I've signed it. And just get out of here. Go home. And he literally, a very strong word, to drive him out. He drove him away. Shlomo. And again, it's interesting. I've always trying to sort of point out here for now, for a number of weeks, that when it says Melech, and it doesn't say Melech. Right here, it doesn't say Vayigaresh Melech Shlomo Teviotah. It's Shlomo Teviotah. In other words, the suggestion is that this is an act not just of the king, but it's an act of personal rejection by Shlomo. Shlomo, in the sense of the spiritual dimension, what Shlomo stood for, and the Shlomo that represents the spirituality of the Jewish people. Vayigaresh Teviotah. He had to push out Eviatar, who was going to go back and function as a kohen. And he, now he's not. Miyot kohen l'Hashem. He's not going to be a kohen anymore. L'malei devar Hashem asher dibar beit Eli b'shilo. And this, of course, is to do with the fact that there's a whole curse on the house of Eli. I don't want to go back over that. That's a story right back at the beginning of Shmuel Aleph. And Eviatar is part of that. And there's a whole background to this. So basically, what happens here is that Eviatar is pushed out. He's no longer persona grata, as they say, in the priesthood. He's out of it. He's not going to be accepted. And here, of course, comes the big problem, which is Yoav. I'm always interested that these names are used quite freely in Israel, you know, by many people. And you wonder sometimes, you know, if people really find out about the characters, whether they would really be so quick to use the name. Yoav is a guy that, as I said, I've got sort of issues, and we'll see over here. One of the main issues which the Pasuk suggests, not only in his death, but about what he was. There are very mixed reviews on Yoav, and it's just going to sort of continue when we learn this story. So look at this, Pasuk Kavchet. Vashmua bad Yoav. Now, of course, Yoav hears the news that Adoniah has been killed, that Eviatar has been sent back to Anatot. He's basically out of there. So he's getting worried. Ki Yoav not achre Adoniah, because he knows that he followed Adoniah, he followed the rebellion, and he was against David. The achre Avshalom lo nata, but he did not follow Avshalom. So you know what? He thought to himself, I've got one strike against me, and I've got one positive side, so maybe I'll be okay. But at this point, he realized that the rebellion of Adoniah was now being cleared up. As it were, Shlomo was wiping up all of the mess. And of course, what did Yoav decide to do? The same thing as Adoniah. Vayonas Yoav el Ohel Hashem. He ran to the Ohel, to the tent of God. Vayichazek bekarnot haMizbeah, and he took hold of the horns of the Mizbeah. Now, this is very odd behavior. We saw it already with Adoniah, and I mentioned that in both cases with Adoniah previously in chapter 1. And now with Yoav, we're actually going to sort of look into this in a bit more detail. Have a look at the page that I gave you, which is taken from the Gemara Makkos. Gemara Makkos in the second perek, and it's underlined in the Gemara. I just put the English translation at the bottom. If you want to sort of keep this as any sort of reference, it's an interesting Gemara. The Gemara is talking over there about the whole question, obviously, of Ir Miklat and Elohim Agolin. This is the whole perek, the second chapter of Makkos. And the Gemara brings the following statement. It's underlined, it's about six lines down. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav, Shtei toyot ta'a Yoav b'oto sha'ah. Yoav made two fundamental errors at this point in time. So it's absolutely going on the subject that we're learning here, and Yoav made very, very serious mistakes. And what are those mistakes? It says, Dichtiv, because it says, Vayanas Yoav, we just read it, Vayanas Yoav, Elol Hashem, Yoav runs to the ark, to the tent of God, Vayichazek b'karnot ha-mizbeach, and he takes hold of the, as it were, the edges, the corners of the Mizbeach. He thought that that was a place of, how should we say, it could be a place of asylum, a place where he won't be touched. Ta'ah, the first mistake that he made, She'eino kolet el gago. V'hu tafas b'karnotov. There is a concept that the top of the Mizbeach, right? Now, who that would be relevant for, presumably, would be the Kohen. If a Kohen was in a situation where he wanted to escape some sort of sentence against him, he would go to the top of the Mizbeach, and you couldn't touch him there. There was like a space there which was, how should you say, it was a no man's land. It was a place where he could be. And Yoav thought that the same thing applied if you held on to the sides of the Mizbeach. If you hold the sides of it, maybe it's the same amnesty. Why you can go to the top? I don't know. It doesn't say, but it says that he made a mistake and he thought holding the Mizbeach would be a siman or a sign or an ability for him to avoid being punished. Very interesting. And it goes on and it says that was mistake number one, that in fact it's only the top, the Mizbeach had like a flat surface at the top of the altar. And that's where you could be if you wanted to apply this particular leniency. So that was mistake number one. And not only that, the second mistake, She'ena kolet el Mizbeach Beit Olamim. It was a law for the Beit HaMikdash. Once the temple was built, this would be applicable in the temple. This was pre-temple. This was a time when they just had a Mishkan. Okay, and therefore what Yoav did was absolutely, for want of a better word, a waste of time. V'hu tafas Mizbeach shel Shiloh. He was in the Mizbeach, the altar which was built in Shiloh, and it didn't have the same status. And not only that, the Gemara goes on and says even more. Abaya says, he made a third mistake. Yoav was very out of character here because he was a very sharp guy. But in this case, he got it wrong. Ta'ah she'ena kolet el kohen v'avodah biyado v'hu zarha. That's what I mentioned just now. That the whole idea was that really this is a law for Kohen. The Kohen, v'avodah biyado, and he was doing the avoda, whatever happened, and he's on top of the Mizbeach, and there's something which he does which is wrong. Maybe he deserves some sort of onus, some sort of punishment, and he is saved at that place. But it only applies to Kohen. And who's Zar? That Yoav was a Zar. Of course, this is essentially the mistake that Adonio made. Adonio got away with it, in the sense that Shlomo gave him another chance. So you can always argue that even with Adonio, it wasn't the Mizbeach that saved him. But in Yoav's case, he thought that that was the way. If it's not going to save him, it might delay the inevitable assassination, the inevitable punishment. But it didn't work. It wasn't correct. And it's just so interesting that, again, weaved into the story, which we don't necessarily get the sense of from the text, once you dip into Talmud, you begin to see that these people are not just political extremists in the sense of cut and thrust political arguments, but that within these arguments are discussions and ideas which emanate from Torah learning. It all revolves around a halacha which Yoav misunderstood. And of course, Talmud does this very, very much. We saw this, of course, with the whole story with the status of King David. King David got a status of being Jewish, but that depended on whether you accept that Ruth, who was a Moabite woman, would be accepted in the Jewish community. The Torah forbids to take converts from Moabite men. So the halacha was established at the time of Shmuel, if not earlier, the time of Ruth, but re-established in Shmuel's days, that the halacha was, it applied to men, but not to women. Okay, Moabite men were not allowed to be Jewish, but Moabite women were accepted. And we saw many times that this whole halacha was questioned. That Doeg had a problem with this, and there was a fabulous story in the Gemara that Amasa ben Yeter, one of the great warriors of King David, he put a sword in the ground And he said, anyone who doubts his halacha will have to deal with this sword. You know, what a way of settling it. Imagine that in the Israeli rabbinate, so that would be scary. You know, I don't want to sort of suggest anything today. It's too political today. It was there as well, but it blows the mind. The whole issue of the way the halacha is woven into the discussion, very, very fascinating. And I just wanted to share this with you because, again, it makes sense. That why would Yaakov go and do such a thing? Why would he run off to the Mizbeah? What did he hope to achieve? And he thought that there's halacha that it gives him a certain amount of asylum. And the answer was, wrong. You're absolutely wrong. In two counts, and according to the Gemara, in fact, three counts. Yeah.
They both knew Yaakov and Adon Yaakov.
Yeah.
But
Me'im does, yeah, but think about it. Me'im doesn't mean Me'ah. That's a taich. That's already the Gemara's, that's a Teresh Baal Peh. I suppose the Mizbeach represents a place of peace. You know, the whole idea that, you know, you don't build the Mizbeach, what is it, you're cutting the stones or whatever, you know, with the Shamir, they use well, you know, it's got a symbol of peace. That's what I guess. And therefore, it's not a place where you go and assassinate somebody. So what do? As you'll see in the Pasuk, they just take him out of it. All right? You know, you wheel him out and you basically take him to wherever and you have to do what you got to do. It's very interesting, this, but I wanted to show you this because, again, you know, it's just a point which we have to be reminded of, that there is a dimension of learning which has within it the kind of halachic dimension, which is not always so obvious. And, you know, we spent a lot of time on this with David and Bathsheba and various other discussions that we had. It's a very challenging but very important aspect of what we're learning. And as I said over here, it's so interesting to me that, again, you know, that there is a kind of inference over here to something which is not so clear in the text, but is certainly clear in the oral tradition. So that was just by the by, and I wanted you to be aware of that. But let's see what happened. Go back to the text. We're looking at Pasuk Chavtet, verse 29. So now we know that Yoav is trying to save his skin. Vayugad lemelech Shlomo kinas Yoav elo Hashem. So Melech Shlomo, King Shlomo, was told Yoav is now hiding or trying to save himself with the Mizbeah. Go and deal with him. And again, interesting, beginning it's a Melech Shlomo, and then at the end it's Shlomo. So there is a kind of dual approach over here. On the one hand, he's doing it as they say in Yiddish, als melech. He's doing it because he's got to establish the rule of kingship. But at the same time, there is a kind of personal issue here, which not only Shlomo had with Yoav, but we know that his father had with Yoav. You know, it was part of the family that they were very scared of. David said it a number of times, that what can I do with Bnei Tzeruya? There were three brothers altogether. Yoav was one of the brothers. So we know, we've already seen this. So again, I just get the sense that here it's Shlomo not only putting his kingship into this, but he's also putting a bit of, personal agenda, personal feeling into this, because he knows what Yoav represented. And what happened, Pasuk Lamed, Vayavo Benayo al Ol Hashem, so Benayo comes to the tent of God, Vayomer Elov, Kama Melech Tzei. So he said, the king says, go out. Vayomer lo, kipo amut. He said, I'm going to die here. In other words, he's trying to put off the evil moment because he feels that the assassination won't take place there. So what happened? Vayosha b'nayo et amela davar lemo. So b'nayo brings back the message saying, ko diber Yoav v'cho'anani. This is what Yoav did. So Vayomer Melech, now as Melech, he's got to now make this decision. He has now absolutely rebelled against my orders. No Rachmonis, he's done. Asay kasher diber, do what he says. Upagabo kvato, in other words, kill him there. If he says that he's not going to leave that place, that's where he's going to die, and that's where he's literally going to be buried. But presumably he was buried outside that space. Vasiroto demechinam, and then you will take away the blood of the innocents of Sheshafach Yov Me'alai, Me'al Beit Avi, which Yov has spilled from me and from my father's family. Basically, Yov is finished. V'heshiv Hashem Adamo Rosho. Now he gets a real hesped here. But Shlomo has got no time for him. He says that God has brought his blood on his head. In other words, his midah k'negi midah. Asher poga b'shnei anashim tzadikim v'tovim b'menu. He killed these two righteous men. V'yargein b'cherev. He killed them by the sword. Remember, he killed Avner ben Ner. And he also killed Amasa ben Yetta. One second, was it Amasa ben Yetta? And Moshe ben Yetzer, he killed both of them. And of course, what does he say over here? V'avid David lo yada. David never knew about it. Et Avner ben Satzva Yisrael, he killed Avner, but Moshe ben Yetzer Satzva Yehuda, he killed Moshe ben Yetzer. So basically, Yoav has now brought upon himself this punishment, and he is finished. V'shav, and this is unbelievable, Arichas, it's unbelievable sort of way that he announces this, the justification for what he is doing. It could very well be that, you know, maybe, I'm kind of speculating, that people might have sensed there was a personal agenda here. So Shlomo has to try and overcome that by saying, you know what, the reality is he brought it on himself. I know that I have very great feelings against Yoav, but at the end of the day, even if you suggest that, the reality is he brought it on his own head. And this is exactly what Shlomo is saying, and therefore it's a bit of a lengthy explanation of why Yoav has to be killed. And Pasalama Gimel Vashavu Demeyan Barosh Yoav, and the blood will come back on to the head of Yoav. In other words, he'll die because of who he killed. Ubarosh Zaro Leolam, and it'll be on the head of his seed. In other words, it's a curse on his family. Uladovid Zaro Lebeitola Kisoye Shalom Ad Olam Me'im Hashem. And to David and his throne, there will be peace forever. And of course, this is unbelievable stuff, what's going on here in terms of the intrigue and the family situation. And this is the decision. Of course, what happens? Lamadalan, Vayyav ben Ben Yodav, Yifkaba v'imiteo, so Benayahu goes and kills him, Vayyikave b'beito b'midbar, and he's buried in his house in the desert, in the wilderness. And immediately the rabbis ask the question, it's brought in Rashi here, he didn't live in the wilderness. He lived presumably somewhere around Yerushalayim. It wasn't in the Midbar. So look what Rashi says over here. And this is the flip side of Yoav. And everybody has got a zechut. It's just an unbelievable thing. But Beito Bamidbar, says Rashi in Lamed Dalet, Shaita Beito Hefke Kemidbar La'aniyim. That his house was an open house for poor people. It was like a wilderness. Everyone could come in and go out whenever they wanted. And of course, that is not a negative thing to say, but it was a very positive thing. So you have this kind of very strange dichotomy, which I said has really come through so often, with Yoav on the one hand being very loyal, on the other hand being very devious, and then in his personal life we get this sense of a man of chesed, because his home was literally open to anyone who wanted to come in, to aniyim, and you know, it was the sort of guy that I suppose you could handle on a Shabbos, but you wouldn't like to handle from Sunday through Friday. He would be the sort of guy you wouldn't want to have anything to do with. Shabbos, I guess, he gave a good Dvar Torah, and he was sort of at home and doing his stuff. It's so intriguing. I just, you know, throw out the ideas here, because those who have been with the program sort of since Yoav sort of featured in big time, as I said all the way along, I really wasn't sure about him, you know, in terms of plus and minus. I'm teaching it now again at Stern. We're going through the same issues all over again with Yoav. And it's just very, very, very intriguing. You know, in his death, there seems to be still a zechut. This Rashi always reminds me of the famous sort of stories about Rav Kook with the early settlers in Israel, and sort of the comments, how could you support them? And, you know, they don't do, you know, what mitzvahs do they do? They're breaking Shabbos, they're doing everything wrong, and people, you know, the old Yishuv got very upset with Rav Kook. And Rav Kook said, but they're doing the greatest mitzvah, building the land of Israel, right? They are actually physically taking the land and salvaging the land. They're clearing the swamps. I mean, this is a great zechut. It's one mitzvah that they have. Maybe they don't have many other mitzvahs, but at least that's one great mitzvah that they're all performing. And he saw, instead of turning it into a negative approach, he always saw the positive. Rav Kook was a very special man in many ways. Alright, so let's see how we go here. And this is kind of sort of the final blow, as it were. Makkah b'patish. Lamed hei. Vayitein ha-melech et Benayahu ben Yehuda tachtav al ha-tzava. So now Benayahu is officially the head of the army. Okay, because this is now official appointment, although he has been essentially doing the job. Ve'et Tzadok ha-kohen natan ha-melech tachat Eviatar. And Tzadok takes over from Eviatar. Basically, the new appointments are made. And what we'll find, which is very fascinating, is that Shlomo is extremely careful. Already we saw it a bit with David, but Shlomo has a tremendous sense of hierarchy of government. It's all good to talk about the day before an election, but the principles of government, which we'll read about in Perek Dalet and Perek Hey, are absolutely amazing. The commentary which will puts it in perspective is the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel, Don Yitzhak Abarbanel, lived in Spain. And not only did he live in Spain, we know that he was very high up in the Spanish government. He was the equivalent, I don't know what the secretary of finance, I think it was, right? He was the minister of finance, very high. He had a chance not to be expelled with the Jews of Spain, and he went with them. He said, I can't stay behind. They're leaving. I'm staying. It was wrong, and he went with them. And they went to Portugal and managed to stay there for a number of years. And it's just very fascinating that when he writes about all of these appointments, he gives the equivalent in the Spanish court of the 1400s. It's so interesting. And he again sees within Shlomo tremendous sense of precedent. You know, this is 2,500 years before government really came together. We're used to the idea of government. We're electing, you know, the checks and balances idea that we have here, or in England, the constituencies and the prime minister and everything, the parties. This is like things that we live with. But in these days, in the days of Shlomo, this was very, very unusual. So the reality of all these appointments, I think, is just worth mentioning at this point. And as I said, it will come out later on when we look at chapter 4 and 5. It's remarkable. Shlomo was really on the ball. He really was on the ball. Yes, Jerry.
I forgot what to mention. The Abarbanel said to Ferdinand and Isabella, he said, history will take care of you. You'll no more be a power.
Yeah, and that's what happened. Yeah, and the other tradition, of course, is that's when he started writing his Perush. I'm not sure whether he wrote it as when he was in government, but once he had time on his hands, like the Ramban. The Ramban went to Eretz Yisrael in 1263, started the journey, and he died in 1275. And those 12 years was probably the most productive years of his life. So, you know, sometimes the greats of history, of Jewish history, they see this kind of situation as a message. You know, this is now the moment. Your life is changing, go with the change and build on it. And they usually end up writing books and doing all this sort of stuff. Very, very, very interesting. We'll come back to the Abarbanel. We're going to say a lot about him. He features very big in Perek Gimel, as we'll see, maybe not today, but certainly next week. The final chapter, or the final part of the chapter here, is the problem of Shimi. Now, Shimi, as I said last week, really is, as strange as the relationship with Yoav was, Shimi is even stranger. Because David was cursed by Shimei, you know, with the whole story with Avshalom. Shimei comes out because he sees the rebellion of Avshalom. He thought he was going to succeed, essentially, and he curses David. And Shimei is recognized as a great teacher. He's recognized as a great role model in terms of somebody who would teach. You know, nowadays, we would say the first grade teacher, or maybe even earlier than that. And, of course, as I pointed out to you already, the tradition is that Shimei is the Rebbe of Shlomo. So at this point in time, Shlomo obviously has gone past Shimei. But the interesting reality is, what does he do with Shimei? You know, your Rebbe, you always have kind of a sense of loyalty and a kind of soft spot for this person. How is Shlomo ever going to be fulfilling what David told him to do, which is to create a situation where Shimei brings the punishment on himself? So listen to this. I'll tell you how smart it is. We'll go with the Malbim on this, and if we have time, I'll show you the text. But of the Malbim, but we'll look at the text inside. Pasuk Lamed Vav. Vayishlach haMelech vayikra leShimei vayomer lo. And again, as Melech, he's sending a message to Shimei. This is not now the student talking to the teacher. This is the king talking to one of his subjects, and he says to him, "Bnei lecha bayit b'Yerushalayim, go and build a house in Jerusalem." Lucky, I mean, you know, you think about it, this is unbelievable bracha that he's giving him. Okay, we should all be so lucky. Go and build a house in Yerushalayim. V'yashavta sham, stay there. V'lo teitze misham ane v'ana. Hither and thither. I like that expression, but it's meaningless in English. Ane v'ana. Now again, how do you understand the command? Don't leave Jerusalem, ane in one direction, v'ana, or in the other direction. That's one possibility of what the message was. Of course, it could be, ane v'ana, is don't leave in a certain direction. What's ane v'ana? The direction of going back to his hometown. Shimei ben Gera was always considered to be dangerous if he would leave Yerushalayim and go in a certain direction back to the place where he comes from, a town which was known as Bachurim. The weather's full of Bachurim, I don't know. Yeshiva Bachurim, who knows why it was called that. But the reality was, that's the town. And if Shimi would go in that direction, he would put his life in danger. That was the deal. So Shimi, in a sense, has been given a command which is a bit ambiguous. And I want to show you this, because the Malbim points this out. And this is really the shtick, the chap, as it were, of Shlomo. Shlomo did not want to go to Shimi and say, you deserve to die, and here's Benayo, and he's going to kill you. That really was, even for the circumstance that we're reading about here, this was for Shlomo, he couldn't do it. So what Shlomo decided to do here was to give Shimi, as it were, an opportunity to hang himself. And the way he did it was by giving a command, which, if Shimi would have stayed in Yerushalayim and never left Jerusalem, he would have lived to a ripe old age, and everyone would have sort of forgotten about him. But Shimi was never going to be like that. So look what happens. Pasuk Lamed Zayin. V'haya b'yom tseitcha, when you leave, v'avarta nachal Kidron, and for instance, you'll go over the Kidron, the river, v'yodo teida ki mot tamud, you will die, your blood will be upon your head. And of course, what is happening here is that the king is giving either an absolute directive that don't go in the north, which presumably where Bachurim was, but the suggestion is, anywhere else, maybe you can go. Or maybe this is just a dugma. You know what, Shimi, for instance, if you want to go back home and go back to Bachurim, the answer is no. You are now in exile. This is like sort of, I remember reading Solzhenitsyn, in the famous Russian author, that spoke about Gorky, right? Gorky was the place, and maybe Boris can tell me about this. There's famous places in Russia where they went for exile, and they lived, you had to live in your whole life was away from the Gulag and wherever, but all these sort of names that we hear from Russian perspective. But this is kind of a similar sense in Jerusalem. Jerusalem became like a place of exile, like an Eir Miklat almost. But with a condition. And the condition was, stay there. And look what happens next. Shimi I think Shimi is trying to use his relationship here and play around with this. Look what he does. Lamed Chet. Vayomesh Shimi Lamelech. Tov adavar shedibar Adonai Amelech. Ken yaseh avdecha. And again, if this is the Rebbe of Shlomo, you almost sense, what's the word I'm looking for here? Kind of, yes, sir. You know, that, like the teacher's being facetious. I can never spell that word. The teacher's being kind of saying, of course I'll do whatever you say. Oh, master. Meaning, of course, you know, I'm your Rebbe, so just remember that. But he's paying homage in a public way, but does he really mean it? That's the question. And his language here, I feel, is a bit flowery. I really sense the kind of, what we'd call tongue-in-cheek, comment here that, you know, maybe Shimi is saying it just to placate the king. Oh, king, yes, I'll do whatever you want, but you know, you're really one of my students, and who are you to tell me what to do? So this is the way I sense it. I'm not sure if I'm right, but this is my sense. So what does Shimi do? So he goes and lives in Jerusalem. You know, I'd be very happy to be forced by the king of Israel to stay and build a house in Yerushalayim. You know, it's not such a bad thing. But of course, Shimi doesn't quite go with this. Look what happens. Pasuk Lamates. 3 years go by. So things are quiet. Shimi behaves himself. And vayivruchu shnei avadim l'shimi. All of a sudden, Shimi's two servants run away. Elachish ben Macha melek Gat, and they go down to Gath. Gath is obviously going down to Gaza today. V'yagidu l'shimi le'mor, hine avadecha b'gat. Your servants are in Gath. And of course, as far as Shimi is concerned, this is a financial loss. You know, you've got two servants running away. Got to go and get them. But why don't you send a shaliach? Why don't you send... It's almost as if he doesn't take the warning seriously. As the Malbim suggests, he didn't take the warning in its bigger context, not just to go in the north direction, which is Jerusalem northward to Bachurim, but also possibly the meaning, the warning was, don't even go Aneva Anas south. Don't go down to Gaza from Jerusalem, south, whatever it is, southwest. Don't go in that direction either. And Shimi ignores that. And look what he does. He goes himself. Possum men, Vayokam Shimi. Sounds like Avraham Avinu is making it into a mitzvah, right? He's saddling the donkey himself. He goes to Gath, to Ochish, the Vakish, the Zavodav, he wants his servants back. He brings them back. Now, and again, I'm pointing out, not Melech, it's like, you know, Shlomo in the sense of, he's now got sort of a personal dilemma. because now he has to enforce essentially the decision of killing Shimei for not obeying his command, and there is a serious issue in Shlomo's mind. I think the Shlomo without the Melech here is showing us the dilemma. And we'd all have the same dilemma, you know, that we have somebody we were close to, but now we're in a position of power, and that person is now put into a very difficult circumstance, or put himself into a difficult circumstance. What do? I'm torn between my personal feelings towards him and my sense of duty that I have to the country. What do I do with Shimei? Yeah. And everyone defends Shimei over here. The answer is, I think that Shimei is also, that's why I said he could have sent a shaliach. He's testing. He's testing the, you know, he's putting his feet in the bath, as they say, you know, seeing if it's hot. And of course, he doesn't dream that Shlomo would carry this out. Almost to the point where maybe he says that what you told me to do was only to go in one direction and I'm going in the opposite direction. You know, he'd have excuses. But Shlomo is looking for some sort of reason here to bring the punishment against Shimei. It's a very interesting story. Yeah.
Well, could it be, because it says Yomim Rabin, he was in Yerushalayim for many days.
Yeah.
Could it be that Shlomo then had this as a ruse?
It's, there's something here where clearly Shlomo is using a tactic, right?
Or he even had them.
You mean to get the Avodin to go and run away? It could be. It's Shlomo was put in a difficult spot.
After Yomim Rabim.
It's Yomim Rabim. He's been told by his father, work it out. Work it out that Shimei eventually will meet, you know, his creator in a premature way. Let's put it that way. Put it in a roundabout way. On the other hand, you know what? He's his Rebbe. And as his Rebbe, you know, what do you do? What do you do in this case? And I can understand this. There must be this sense of division of loyalty, which must be very, very tough for him. And you'll see how the pasuk reads out. Look at Membet. Vayishlach ha-melech vayikra l'shimi. Now he calls to him as melech, because he has to deal with him. If he's dealing with him on a personal basis, as Shloimele, the Talmud Muvak of Shimei ben Gera, he's not going to be able to handle this. So what has he got to do? He's got to send a message as Melech. Now he's got to act towards Shimei with absolute decisive majesty. There's no other way to deal with it. So Vayishlach HaMelech Vayikra LeShimei, calls to Shimei, Vayom Elav Haloish Baticha Bashem. I made you swear in the name of God. There was an oath. The question is, where was this oath? There's a whole discussion in the Mefarshim here. We'll talk about that in a minute. Let's just finish the story. And I made you testify, whenever you leave Jerusalem to go, whichever direction, you will die. And you agree to it. You agree to the condition. Umadua. And he says, why? And it's such a powerful word. Madua, you know, there's an easy word in Hebrew, lama. But madua is always why in the sense with a what's the word in Yiddish? You know, when you krechts, right? When you have this sense of sighing. Madua, why Shimei? Why didn't you stay in Yerushalayim? Why didn't you take me seriously? Why did you try to push the envelope the way you did? And I've got to now do what I've got to do. And I'm king and I can't compromise on this. It's very, you know, you sense that frustration. Umadua lo shamarta tshuvat Hashem, v'ata mitzvah shetiviti alech. Why didn't you keep the mitzvah? And then memdala v'yom ha-melech al-shimi, ata yadata, again, talking to him as melech. He can't talk to him now as Shlomo. He's got to talk to him as melech, because the only way he can handle this. Ata yadata et kol ha-ra'a sheyadala v'avecha, now you will know all the evil that your heart has known. Asher asita l'david avi, you did to my father. V'yishiv Hashem et ra'atcha b'roshecha, and the evil is visited upon you. Va'melech Shlomo Baruch. King Shlomo is blessed. V'kisei David yeh nachon. Lifnei Hashem adolam. And the throne of David will be established forever. And of course, again, I think it's just so significant. I just sense this dilemma that Shlomo is going through. And of course, Memvam, Vayitzav HaMelech, he has to command as king. I can't tell him as Shlomo, go and kill my Rebbe. That would be impossible. But as King Shlomo, as the representative of the kingdom of Israel, that's the only decision that has to be put out there, that what has to be done, and Shimi is going to be killed. And this is the last pasuk here. Vayitzav HaMelech ben Ayo ben Yehuda, Vayitzei Saben Yahu, the head of the army goes out, Vayifgar bo v'yamot, and he kills him. V'amamlacha nechona biyad Shlomo, and now the kingship is established, interestingly, not biyad Melech Shlomo, biyad Shlomo. In other words, after this, maybe he can go back to being Shlomo again. In other words, what I'm suggesting is there's always going to be the tension between his emotional status, his status as a rabbinic figure, if you want to call it that, as a Talmudic figure, whatever religious status you want to give him, and as the king. And why I introduce all of this concept is because in the next chapter, Mirtz Hashem, is the famous story of Mishpat Shlomo. And there you'll see there's a famous question that why did Shlomo not apply halacha? The actual halacha that you could have applied in that case is a very simple halacha, Motzi Mechaver al Varai. So Gemara mentions it how many times? Hundreds of times. And Shlomo doesn't apply it in that case with the baby. And we're going to be dealing with the same terminology, that there is a concept when Shlomo is doing his stuff as Shlomo, and then there's another concept where Shlomo is doing his stuff as Melech Shlomo. And I think I just want to, again, if it's getting repetitive, I hope by the time we've said it a few times, it sinks in, because I think it's really revealing in the story here. The Malbim points out, we don't have time to look at the text, but he points out here that there is the concept, what it says, Mamlacha, because normally we would say Malchut, what's a Mamlacha? So he points out that there's a difference. Malchut is generally the kingdom, referring to the king's position. Mamlacha is the idea of the country. Mamlacha means that now not only is the king's position safe, but the country is now nechona, is in a solid position. The enemies from within are no longer around. Now this again, of course, is very revealing in terms of political, sort of debate and whatever, that there can be a debate, but when there's dissension to the point of rebellion, then the country falls apart. I just want to very briefly, I'm going to be brave, and just read to you the first pasuk of chapter 3, which is really, to me, a continuation of what we just saw in its own way, because now Shlomo has got rid of the enemies, he's got to start building his own household. So what does he do? And I'm going to leave you with a whole bunch of questions here. Vayitchaten Shlomo et Paro melech Mitzrayim. As you say, muchutonim. The idea that he made this marriage connection through the daughter of Paro, the king of Egypt, he married the daughter of Pharaoh. Very interesting. And of course, I'll just read you the Rashi over here, which is a kind of epitaph to Shimi. And it shows how Shlomo, as Shloimele, really was still under the influence of Shimi. Look what it says here. Vayitchaten Shlomo, he got married to this girl. I'm not going to go into the marriages. That'll be next week. Mirtz Hashem, we'll talk about that. The Barbanel, again, has got a tremendous insight to this. But just look at the Rashi here, because it's such an interesting conclusion. He says, Kol Zaman, Shaya Shimi Rabo Kayam, as long as Shimi was alive, Lo Nitchaten Bo. He did not get married to the daughter of Pharaoh. So he behaved himself, that's the suggestion, as long as his Rebbe was around, Shloimele was a good boy. Mikan Omru, that's why the rabbis say, La'olam yidor adam, yidor adam, b'makom rabbo. Always live in the place where your teacher lives, because it will keep you in check. Wonderful, wonderful thought at the end of this particular discussion that we had today, that in the end of the day, Shimi clearly, at this point, even though Shlomo has dealt with him as Melech Shlomo, but in terms of Reb Shlomo, the Shlomo, the Talmud, and Shimi the Rebbe, that seems to have had an influence right to the moment of Shimi's death. So interesting. The questions obviously are going to be, what is this whole policy of Shlomo marrying now so many wives, which we're going to have to deal with? Are we dealing with a very impetuous young man who basically, the expression in English, sowing his wild oats? I mean, is that what we're going to say about Shlomo HaMelech? He's a very young guy and this is what he's doing. And of course, the religious question is about the status of these women. Does he actually convert them? The Rambam says they have to have been converted. But as I mentioned, maybe I mentioned this already, I'm still trying to work out who lit the Shabbos candles. You know, he's got all these wives there. There was not one of them was Jewish. They were all converts. Shlomo did not marry a nice Jewish girl from Bnei Brak. It's really quite a shock to the system. And all of this will become sort of clear as we go along. Bezrat Hashem, next week we'll be looking at Perek Gimel. Read ahead, read on. It's this famous story of the Nevuah of Shlomo, and of course, by the end of Perek Gimel, the famous Mishpat Shlomo. Again, we have a lot to say about that, please God, in the coming weeks. We wish everybody a good evening. Thank you. Oh, final question. Yes. Say Shlomo is totally in accordance with Hashem, and Melech Shlomo is in accordance with the general principles of Dina de Malchuta, the law of the land, which he is establishing in terms of being the king. He has taken this whole kingship to a new level. David basically built the foundation and expanded Israel, as we saw, and made the power base. But now Shlomo is, in terms of the security, let's call it the security zone, around the country. Now Shlomo is doing much, much more. Shlomo is developing international relations. Shlomo is going out there to become part of the world. And of course, in that sense, yes, he's being faithful to the tenets of Judaism, but you know what? There are certain things where, as they say in the classics, he's going to have to wing it. And he wings it big time in so many instances. And you know, it comes to a point where there's a confusion. And it's something we're going to say right at the end when we get to Perek Gedolah, that the Shlomo Melech and Shlomo without the Melech become very, for want of a word, conflicted. And we're going to talk about that. It becomes a big issue later on. But thank you for raising that. Yes, final comment.
Isn't it controversial? No, but David wanted to build temple.
Yes.
But it was said because he was warrior and killed people, he cannot make...
One of the reasons. Yeah, we went into all of that.
But Shlomo, we read today... People.
Well, he didn't do it himself. David had blood on his hands. Shlomo always got somebody else to do it. So that's, I suppose, one of the reasons why, you know, you do it with the shliach. So you'll say to me, but the Gemara says, shlucha shel adam kamoto, that the shliach is like the person himself, so really it's Shlomo doing the... You know, the answer is that in this case, on the advice of his father, I'm not going to put this in the same category as what David was doing. And in fact, Shlomo, the great thing about Shlomo is that in his whole 40 years of kingship, there were no wars, really almost to the end. Not everything was like as utopian as you could ever imagine. It's the Israel that we all dream about one day that will be back again, please God, because it's just unreal. What we're going to read about now is really uplifting. Bezrat Hashem. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for listening. Have a good one.